I am Planta on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. Teresa Kishkin joins me now. She's just published a fascinating, captivating memoir, The Art of Looking Back, A Painter, An Obsession, and Reclaiming the Gaze. At the age of 23, she's just finished school and was still living with her parents in Victoria. She was about to go to Europe for an extended time, but just before, she meets and models for the artist Jack Wilkinson. He had been a member of the Limners, a group of artists who came together in the 1960s, not just painters like Wilkinson, but also sculptors, ceramicists, and other visual artists, including Maxwell Bates, Mofani Pavelic, Robert DeCastro, and Robin Skelton, among others. Teresa knew some of them socially, so it wasn't like Wilkinson was a stranger. He soon pursues Teresa as a model, and in candid and often personal letters proposes much more than an artist-muse relationship. He's married, but he claims the marriage is ending. She's not interested in any of this, of course, but she doesn't say much. She leaves for Europe, and when she comes back years later with a husband, John Pass, and children, he finds her, and the letters continue. The book explores how, in retrospect, she realizes the incongruity of it all. She sees, rereading the letters, how inappropriate Wilkinson was, especially when he propositions Teresa, but also when he discusses the earlier obsession he had with his daughter. The book is awfully timely as our culture tries to reckon with the destructive male gaze and try to do away with revenge porn, something that's similar in how Wilkinson depicts Teresa in his art. Teresa is candid in the book about how the portrait of her in Wilkinson's art has not been something she's reconciled with, despite the piece that's on the cover of the book hangs in her home, something she'd see on a daily basis. I'll ask her about the work she's gone through to get to a place of addressing this important part of her life and the ongoing relationship we have with the art of artists who are not just complicated but problematic. Visit TeresaKishkin.com for her website and her regular blog. Teresa Kishkin is the author of 16 books, which include books of memoir, essays, poetry, and novellas. This new book is published by Thornapple Press. We spoke earlier this month with Teresa joining me from her home on the Seychelles Peninsula. Please welcome back to the Plant Online program, Teresa Kishkin. Ms. Kishkin, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. It's nice to talk to you again.
Oh, what a pleasure.
One of the things I enjoyed about the book is that you, and I've enjoyed this about your writing over the years, is that you are talking to us, or you're speaking to one reader, if you will. That's how it reads to me, and I find you're awfully candid and honest, and there's almost nothing that one can't ask you. Was that the sort of relationship that you had with Wilkinson as well, that he was, because in his letters he shares a great deal with you?
He does, yeah.
But did you find that you were able to ask him anything, you know, from your part, say?
I don't remember thinking that there was much I needed to ask, because he was just so outgoingly, you know, intimate.
Yeah.
He told me everything, and it was a little uncomfortable, but also interesting. I mean, as much as I found the relationship that I had with him troubling then, and then I told myself that it was actually an interesting experience, and then revisited it a few years ago because of a series of things that came together, kind of conspired together to make me revisit it.
Mm-hmm.
I became interested in actually how inappropriate he was as an older artist to someone who was young enough to be his daughter.
Yeah, and you know, this is forgive me. This does not. I don't want to sound like I'm blaming you. But because you do blame yourself for a lot of things in the book, but you know, as I'm reading the book, You know, there's so many red flags, if you will, or moments where I'm like, I want to yell at young Teresa saying, hey, don't you see that that's a problem? Don't you see that this isn't right?
Oh, I understand that now. I didn't then. I think I was so ill-prepared to be the object of someone's obsession. There was nothing in my life that had prepared me for that. So it took some, time for me to figure out that that's what was going on. And yeah, I was uncomfortable, and he was obsessive and overbearing and manipulative and charming, which is a very interesting combination, I think. So I just found it difficult to extricate myself from it, and I found it difficult to keep a distance.
Yes.
Because I was 23. I wasn't particularly experienced in the kind of relationship that it was developing into.
So he was 23. How old was he?
I was 23. He was 51.
Yeah. And so I guess, had you known of his work or his renown, say, or was it mainly that he was a friend of friends?
I was familiar with the Limners, a group of painters or visual artists in Victoria, familiar with their work because I was a student of Robin Skelton's, who was one of the Limners. And I'd got to know a couple of them at different events at the Skelton's house and at art shows in Victoria. But it wasn't until 1978 that I went to a show of the Limners at a gallery in East Saanich and met Jack, and it was a group show of all the Limners that were then alive and actively at work. There were a couple of them who had already died at that point. Richard Chuchimara, one of them, and I think Robert DeCastro as well.
So, you know, at the same time, you're right, you know, he's an interesting person, and you were flattered by the attention. You also write in the book that you seem to attract men of his age rather than, say, the young men that you wanted to date. I was going to say heady, but that's not the right word. It's such a fascinating combination when you're 23 and you get this attention.
Oh, it was. It was fascinating, and it was flattering. I write in this particular book, and I've written in earlier books, that I had a complicated relationship with my own father. I know that he loved me, but we didn't have... Well, actually, we did have a lot in common, but we kind of avoided ever talking about that for a whole lot of reasons. And so I didn't have much attention from him. And when these older gentlemen started noticing me and paying me attention, I guess I was flattered. And I found them interesting. I mean, Jack, for all his manipulation and troubling behavior, was charming and interesting. So, I mean, of course I blame myself in lots of ways. I should have been wiser, and I should have been, careful, and wasn't.
Yeah. I don't want to sound like I'm blaming, but you know, this cuts both ways too, doesn't it? I mean, some people might say that why are you doing this now, especially since he's dead, since Gina's dead, his daughter?
Mm-hmm.
He can't defend himself. But then at the same time, I'm thinking just because he's dead, he shouldn't avoid blame.
Well, I have to say that it's very much an accidental memoir. It's a book I never intended to write. But about 3 years ago, 4 years ago, there were three things that came together. One of them was that my papers had been requested and bought by the University of Victoria.
Mm-hmm.
And I handed them over, but I found this large folio of letters from Jack Wilkinson. And I thought, I'll reread those before I hand them over. And it was a good place for them, would be a good place for them to go, because the University of Victoria also holds the Limner's archive.
Mm.
And so I held them back and reread them and realized that the story that I'd told others than myself about this relationship, or that story, was only part of it.
Mm.
And so I was thinking about that, and then my daughter in Victoria has a friend who's a painting conservator, and she was restoring a painting of Jack's, and she said to my daughter, I'm working on a painting of your mother. And my daughter said, well, if it's Jack Wilkinson, he painted women who sort of looked like her. It might not be her.
Mm.
And her friend said, oh, it's your mother. And so I was thinking, so there's a painting that I don't know about. How many more might there be? And then the next thing was that, the third thing was, on the cover of this book, there's a detail from a portrait of me at 23, and it's hanging in our house at the foot of the stairs that I come down every morning from my bedroom to the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And I see this version of myself at 23. She's looking slightly to the side, and for the past 40 years, I've looked at the painting, and I've wondered about her, and it just seemed that it was time to talk to her and find out what it was she had to tell me about that time. So those three strands, if you like, came together, and I started to think about them and realized that they were the strands of something that I needed to write. I needed to find out how they fit together, and I needed to find out how I felt about this whole experience.
Yeah.
Now, as a you know, mother and grandmother.
I'll get back to the letters in just a moment. That photo that you've been, pardon me, that painting that you've been seeing,
mm-hmm.
regularly for 40 years, there were times when it was hard to look at for you, right?
Yes, there were. I often don't sleep well, and sometimes when I come downstairs, I sort of sit on the stairs partway down and sort of think about how to begin the day. And I'd look up, and she was there. And she made me uncomfortable, the way she sort of looked aside. There was something slightly accusatory in her glance, and I didn't really know what to do about it.
So is that you, or is that how he saw you?
Well, actually, there are photographs that I realized he'd worked from. He took some photographs on this picnic that we went on one day. And in the photographs, I look much younger than that painting. The painting is in a way an anticipation. It's my younger self, but it's also an anticipation of who I might become. So you know, it's a little complicated. Is it me?
Yeah.
Is it my younger self? Is it a intermediary between that time and this time? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But I'm much more mm-hmm. comfortable with her now.
Yeah. Yeah, and you work through that throughout the book, which is fascinating to see. A relationship between a person in a painting, and... well, I don't want to presume this, but maybe even the painter himself. It's this ongoing relationship that
mm-hmm.
that's being mm-hmm. revisited constantly, or not constantly, but regularly from time to time. And I said a moment ago, you know, there were moments where I wanted to, you know, yell at young Teresa, you know, watch out. But you know, the thing.
Join the club, Joe.
But the one thing that I see throughout the book is this incredible growth, not just as a person, but, you know, as you said a moment ago, as a mother, as a grandmother, as an artist herself. The book is awfully timely, because you mentioned revenge porn near the end of the book. And this is something that, because you talked about this painting that your daughter's friend, that you, was restoring that you didn't know about. And so it's very much akin to revenge porn, isn't it?
I think it certainly is. So just to be clear and to be honest, I sat naked for Jack Wilkinson once. And from that afternoon, he made thousands of drawings, and certainly a number of paintings. That one that I referred to that was in the process of being restored, I'd know nothing about it. And it's owned by a collector in Victoria who very kindly photographed it and allowed us to use it in this book. There are many more. And would I have agreed to that? I didn't know that I was allowed to agree to it. I didn't know that. But it's very timely that images can be made of you and distributed and you have no knowledge of them. Has my life been ruined because of that? No. But an interesting thing to think about.
Now I want to go back to the letters, because they're awfully candid on his part. Some of them are disturbing. Some of the things he says are lascivious and inappropriate in then and now. And as I understand from what I recall reading in the book, that you sought a therapist who suggested that you burn the letters.
Yeah. Now that was after I read them about 3 or 4 years ago. Writing this book, reading the letters and writing it, really kind of unsettled me for a time.
I'll bet, yeah.
And I wanted to talk to someone about it, and I did see a therapist, and she said about the letters, burn them, you know, just get rid of them. And I thought about that, and I thought, no, I think they have archival value, so I didn't. It would have been cathartic, maybe, but I found other ways to come to terms with them. So I have them. I haven't delivered them to join my other papers at the University of Victoria, but maybe soon.
Yeah, your son Forrest, a distinguished archivist in Ottawa, he talked you out of destroying them. Is that right?
He said he thought they were important social documents, and I have 3 children. I was a little concerned that they might be troubled by this.
Yeah.
And he said, "Oh no, you know, this is history. It's important." So he was very adamant that I shouldn't burn them.
One of the I guess I don't know how to put this. One of the more candid parts of the letters is when he talks about his daughter Gina, and even before you'd met him, around the time you'd met him, you'd heard whiffs of chatter about something that might have happened between him and his daughter Gina. He writes to you about the hurt. That she's got a boyfriend now, and we find out later who he was, a filmmaker, and he, did you know at that moment that because you looked similar to her, that perhaps because she was gone to him now, or away from him, or apart from him, that you were sort of filling that place?
I think I intuited it, yeah. We did look very similar when we were young. We didn't look so similar as we aged, but we did look similar. And she was no longer available to him. And I think he was perhaps interested in finding someone who might fill that place in his life.
So it began with you, invitations to come and pose. Mm-hmm. He was married at the time. Mm-hmm. And then as you get to know one another, it becomes, he proposes something sexual, which doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. But that continues even after you've had children, right?
Yes. Well, I didn't stay in touch with him after I returned from Ireland. I went to Ireland shortly after I knew him.
And that was a plan from the beginning, too, right?
It was planned from the beginning, although he tried to talk me out of it. Mm. And I went, and we had a correspondence that became even more troubling because he was angry that I'd left and going through some difficulties in his personal life as well. And when I came back, I saw him once or twice, and then I thought, no, I just don't want this to continue with this. And I met the man that I married. And a few years after we were married, Jack tracked me down again through a mutual friend. And he sort of insinuated himself into our lives. And that's the part that I think I was confused about during my life. I told myself that it was a friendship, and it was. But when I read the letters, which I hadn't ever read very carefully when they arrived in 1981 or 1984 or 1989, they would arrive 20-page letters, and I had three little children and a very busy life, and I would read the first page or two, and they would become obsessive and manipulative, and I would think, oh, I'll just put this aside and maybe read it later, and I didn't read them again until about 3 years ago, and so he would visit us. Mm-hmm. He would bring paintings as gifts for my children. And on the surface, it was cordial and kind of affectionate. But there was always an undercurrent. And I recognized that immediately when I reread his letters, that the undercurrent was that I belonged to him and that we needed to, become involved again.
Yeah, there's a lunch at a French restaurant here at Vancouver.
Mm-hmm. I wish I could remember the name of it.
It was on Thurlow, you said.
Thurlow, yeah.
You brought one of your children as a baby.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm curious to know, because during the lunch he's sketching you.
Mm-hmm.
He's plying you with chocolate mousse and at one point you have to nurse the baby.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's at the table. What does that child think of being brought into that situation at that moment, sir?
What is which? Sorry, I didn't hear.
What is that child?
That was my oldest son.
Uh-huh.
And Forrest, and he and I are the subject of a painting, which is actually hanging above me as I talk to you. It's in our living room, and it was a sort of a Madonna and Child painting. It's very beautiful, and it's, the product of his obsession, there are always two sides to this thinking about him, that quite often what resulted from the obsession is quite beautiful. And, does that justify the, you know, the pain and the uncertainty and the discomfort. I don't know.
Yeah, I guess we've had this discussion over the years in our culture about whether one can separate the artist from the art.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a wonderful book in which the subject of some of his art has to reckon with all of this.
Yeah. Yeah, and that does happen sometimes. I mean, during the writing of this, I started to read Celia Paul's memoir about her life with Lucian Freud, her early life with Lucian Freud. She was a model of Freud's and the mother of one of his children. I think he had just dozens and dozens of children with many, many women. She thinks about that relationship too, the relationship between having been his model and then seeing the works and wondering about the relationship between those two things. She's a little cooler and a little, because she's an artist herself, a visual artist herself, and she understands something of the process, but I'm not sure I ever quite sorted it out for myself.
Is it easier when you're not involved, say, like if we're talking about a troublesome filmmaker or another painter?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, I love Picasso.
Yeah.
Would I have wanted to have been involved with him? No. And do those beautiful paintings justify the way he treated his wives and other women? I don't think so. But what do we do with the paintings now? I mean, I think some of them are just ravishing. So it's complicated, isn't it?
Yeah. The way I've worked through this is, like, you know, Woody Allen is obviously a problematic person in our culture, but, you know, I don't think we should stop watching Annie Hall.
No.
Or any of these things, because it's not just a Woody Allen film, it's a Diane Keaton film, it's a Gordon Willis film.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we have to, we have to understand, you know, why he's a troublesome person.
Mm-hmm.
But we
and
can...
also the art is its own thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it survived the making of it, I think. It doesn't mean that we don't ask the questions and deplore the behavior and so on, but the art's important, I think.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead, please.
I was just going to say that I was in Paris last year, and every other time I tried to go to the Picasso Museum, it had been closed for renovations or whatever. But we did go, and I'm so grateful for those works. I mean, they make us see things differently.
Yeah.
They're so of their time. The best of them are transcendent. So I'm grateful for them.
I want to ask about your husband, John Pass, and his memories of Wilkinson. What did he think of him? You know, him hanging around as he was in those days, say?
I think he was charmed by him. He was a charming man. But I also think that he understood, you know, that he was complicated and certainly supported me when I was writing this book, totally supported me. In fact, it's published because he and one friend who'd read the manuscript insisted that it might be of value to other people. I'd written it really for myself, and John and the friend to whom the book is dedicated both said, I think that other people would you know, find something important here. This is, versions of this have happened to other women, and you know, so John's always been very supportive.
Yeah, you write in the acknowledgments. He understood the weight of this story on your life. I guess we all wish that of the people around us, especially when times are challenging, not just in the moment, but over 50 years.
He would have supported me whatever I decided to do with this story, I think. And he also, I think, understands that it's mine to tell.
Mm.
I had people wonder about other people in the book, whether or not it was appropriate to use names for other people who I refer to. And I guess the way I feel about that is that this is very much my story. But when it overlapped with others, it was important to include them. And it would have been coy not to have used their names. So.
Yeah, you write in the book that you have changed some names, but there's some names who have a public presence whose names weren't.
That's right.
Right? Yeah.
So, for instance, the filmmaker that you referred to, Adam Aboyan, we did, the publisher and I did send this book in its early, the arc of it, before it was printed. We sent that to Adam just to run it by him. And he wrote back and said he thought it was, a terrific book. So I think he wasn't troubled by it.
I was going to ask you who needs to read the book, but you've alluded to that already. I guess the as I was reading the book, because I'm a guy, there are aspects of what happened to you and your experience that I probably will never completely understand because I'm a guy. But I can't tell you how valuable it was reading the book, because then I can see the signs of somebody who is obsessive, who is overbearing, manipulative. And if I see that in other people, I mean, I can be a friend and warn other people, I guess. I mean,
well, that's such a useful thing. I mean, this particular power imbalance, we'd like to think that we've evolved beyond that, but we haven't.
Mm.
And it still continues. And, I think we're much more aware of the importance of consent now in the use of images of people. And I wish I'd been, informed as a 23-year-old.
Mm.
But I wasn't, and I have chosen to write about it now. So
in choosing to write about it, Teresa, because I said a moment ago I saw the growth, obviously, of a person from 23 to today. Do you feel that? Do you feel that after having written this, that you've made peace with the things that are obviously troublesome, that are obviously troubling?
I do. I have some sympathy for Jack, and I have some sadness for him. I mean, his life didn't end well. I think he was estranged from people that he loved. And he, I think he had a lot of difficulties. And I've lived a life that I'm so grateful for, continue to be grateful for on a daily basis. So does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, that does. You mentioned a moment ago that some of the letters went into the late 80s. And then in the book, I think you write that they ended abruptly in 1997. Was there a reason that they ended abruptly as they did?
I don't think there was. I think we just stopped writing. He stopped writing to me and I stopped writing to him. He died in 2007, and I think he'd had a number of years with really poor health.
Mm-hmm.
And the sadness is that his entire family is dead. His daughter and his sons and his ex-wife,
mm-hmm.
they're all gone. So it's a sad legacy, I think.
But the art endures.
It does.
But again, it's a wonderful, the book is a wonderfully cautionary tale in that we have to, when we say see some of his work, as we do in, on the cover of your book even, we need to know that there's a story there beyond just the art itself.
And I think that that was really my intention, you know. It's the art of looking back and understanding the dimensions of painting and the relationships that are foundational to the work. And so I'm glad to have written it.
Yeah, it is a gift because it's beautifully written, but it also provides something useful for all readers, I think. There's a couple places in the book where you write about being at a time in your life where you didn't write much. You know, one moment, I guess, is when your children were small and the house was busy. What do you do when the writing doesn't come easily, say? I mean, do you find that there are ways to recharge the batteries of creativity, say?
Well, I think I've always done other things as well. So I do textile work and I grow food and flowers. And I think all of those are part of this continuum. Writing's one element of it.
Mm.
And eventually with writing, there were a few years where I really despaired. I thought I probably wouldn't ever find my way back to it. But when I did, I realized that I had this rich hoard of experience and imagery and detail to bring to it. So now if I have a period where I'm not doing much, I remember that and know that, you know, the waiting is part of the work too.
Yeah, there are other parts of the as I was reading the book where I envied your ability to look back and find something there, you know, that you may not have thought was useful then, maybe, but you know, 50 years later, it's just rife for exploration, and you do so in a way that's so thoughtful. You know, I was thinking of your parents as I was reading the book, because they're in the story,
mm-hmm.
but they're not the main characters, but they're having to endure some of these early moments alongside
mm-hmm.
you.
Mm-hmm.
Have you written about your parents before?
I have written about them in individual essays in previous collections. I do, the older I get and the more I, well, I wish I'd known them better, and there are things about them that I wish I'd known. As I explore family history and genealogy, there are stories that I didn't know. My mother was given up at birth and never knew her biological parents, was put into foster care, and in the last 4 or 5 years, I've discovered who her birth parents were and something of their story, and I've made some links with people who would have been her family if she'd been kept by her mother.
Uh-huh.
And part of me would like to write about that eventually. I'm not sure.
But it seems from listening to you just now that you've come to understand both your mother and your father more in recent years than, say, before.
Well, I guess in understanding where they came from, it gives me some insight into their own personalities and their own expectations of their children and their own fears for their children. They came from, you know, pretty rough beginnings. And so I think what I feel now also is a tenderness towards them.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't have been anything other than who they were. And I guess I hoped when I was younger that they might be, you know, the way that one does. I wish sometimes wish that they'd been more supportive of me and what I was doing, but they didn't have models for that. Couldn't really have done that naturally, I don't think.
Yeah, I brought up your parents because there's a moment in the book where you have to contend with a stalker. And the stalker makes contact, not necessarily with you, but with them, your mother in particular, and says awful things about you and things that suggests things that you've done that you hadn't done, obviously. But your mother takes the stalker side and believes them, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I bring that up just because I want to let people listening to us know why I brought them up to begin with,
mm-hmm.
because that's a relationship that you mention that I think we'll all find something useful there in terms of how to react when people around us are being harmed.
Yeah, and I think they just wouldn't have known.
It's a different generation too, isn't it?
Yeah. But, I mean, it makes one mindful, doesn't it, of how to be aware of what's going on with one's own children and grandchildren and friends, people that we're close to.
Yeah. I've just glanced at the clock, and I've kept you longer than I said I would. But, I mean, again, the only reason is because I could ask you or talk to you about anything, and that's your compliment. I found the book so worthwhile. I've had it for a while now, and I was going to say I enjoyed it, but that's not the right word. I just found something out of it that I needed, and so congratulations on the book. I hope it does really well because people deserve to read it.
Thank you, and thanks for talking to me. You asked such good questions.
Thanks so much. The website for more is at teresakishkin.com. This new book is called The Art of Looking Back, A Painter, An Obsession, and Reclaiming the Gaze. It's published by Thornapple Press. Its author, Teresa Kishkin, joined me on the line from her home on the Seashell Peninsula in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Planta.